For 3 days the St. Louis had sat at anchor kilometers from shore. For 3 days, while port officials came and went, the Cuban police who guarded the ladder off the ship told the passengers they couldn't leave today. Mañana, they said. Mañana. Tomorrow, tomorrow. 2 days ago, the SS Orduña, a smaller English passenger liner, had arrived and anchored nearby. Joseph guessed it was one of the other two ships they'd been racing to Cuba. He and the other passengers had watched as launches went to and from the ship, as the yellow quarantine flag went up and then down. And then the Orduña had lifted anchor and cruised in to dock at the pier and let off passengers. Why had they been allowed to dock and not the St. Louis? The St. Louis had gotten there first. Captain Schroeder wasn't around to ask, and the officers and stewards had no answers for the passengers. And then today, the same thing had happened with the French ship SS Flandre. It arrived, anchored nearby, passed quarantine, docked at the Havana pier, and let off its passengers. Now it was sailing back out to sea. The passengers on the St. Louis had grown more and more restless, cornering sailors on deck and berating their stewards at dinner. Joseph had felt the tension mounting all over the ship, the pandemonium threatening to boil over every time the crew dealt with the passengers. It was as suffocating and oppressive as the 100-degree heat. Apparently, Schindig and his Nazi friends had felt the tension too, because that's when the firemen patrols had begun. It was nothing official, Joseph was sure, because the captain hadn't made an announcement. It was just certain members of the crew who had taken it upon themselves to police the ship like they were all back in Germany.
"For the safety of the Jews," Schindig told them, the same way the Gestapo took Jews into protective custody.
Another fireman stood beside the one who held Joseph's arm, blocking out the sun, and between them was Otto Schindig himself.
"Just the boy we were looking for," Schindig said. "You are to come with us."
"What? Why?"
Joseph asked, looking up at the two big men around him. Joseph felt guilty, and he was immediately mad at himself for it. Why should he feel guilty? He hadn't done anything wrong. But he remembered feeling this way back home, too, whenever he passed a Nazi on the street. In Germany, just being Jewish was a crime. And here, too, apparently.
"Your parents' cabin must be searched," Schindig said. "You have a key?"
Joseph nodded, even though he didn't want to. These men were adults, and they were Nazis. One he'd been taught to respect. The other he'd learned to fear. The big fireman still had Joseph's arm, and he pulled him toward the elevator. Joseph couldn't believe he'd let himself be caught. He'd warned his little sister, Ruthie, to avoid the firemen, who loved to intimidate the children on board, and she'd managed to stay out of their way. But he'd lost himself watching the Flandre sail out of Havana Harbor, his back turned to the promenade, and that's when they'd caught him. Schindig and his firemen hustled Joseph down the stairs, and Joseph's stomach sank when they ordered him to open the door to his cabin. Joseph's hand shook as he put the key in the lock. He wished there was some way he could get out of this, some way he could keep these men away from his mother and father. Otto Schindig reached down and turned the handle for him, throwing the door open. Papa lay on a bed in his underclothes, trying to stay cool in the stifling heat. Mama sat in a chair nearby, reading a book. Ruthie, Joseph was glad to see, was still up at the pool. When she saw the men, Rachel Landau stood. On the bed, Joseph's father propped himself up, a look of panic on his face.
"What's going on here?" Mama asked. "Joseph?"
"They made me bring them here," Joseph said, his eyes wide, trying to warn her of the danger.
"Yes," Schindig said, spotting Joseph's father. "There he is."
Schindig and the two firemen stepped inside. Schindig closed the door and locked it behind them.
"For your safety, this cabin must be searched," Schindig said.
"On whose authority?" Mama asked. "Does the captain know about this?"
"On my authority," Schindig told her. "The captain has other things to worry about."
Schindig nodded, and the two firemen ransacked the room. They swept Mama's makeup and perfume off the vanity and smashed the mirror. They knocked the lamps off the bedside tables and cracked the wash basin. They opened up the family's suitcases, which were carefully packed and ready to go to Cuba, and threw their clothes all over the cabin. They tore the head off Ruthie's stuffed bunny. They snatched the book from Mama's hands and ripped out the pages, tossing them in the air like ashes from a bonfire. Joseph's mother cried out, but not so loudly that anyone else would hear. Papa wrapped himself in a ball and threw his hands over his head, whimpering. Joseph huddled against the door, angry at his helplessness, but scared that if he fought back, he'd only be punished more. When there was nothing left to smash or scatter, the fireman stood behind Shindik at the door. Shindik spat on the floor.
"That's what I think of you and your race," he said.
And suddenly Joseph understood. This was payback for his father's words to Shindik at the funeral. Shindik snorted dismissively at the cowering man on the bed.
"It's time you had your head shaved again," he told Joseph's father.
Otto Shindik let himself and the two firemen out, leaving the door wide open. Joseph's mother slid to the floor crying, and Papa blubbered on the bed. Joseph shook as he buried his face in his hands, trying to hide his own tears. He wanted nothing more than to run to his mother's arms, but she felt a million miles away from him. So did his father. They were three lonely islands, separated by an ocean of misery. Of all the things Shindik and his firemen had broken, the Landau family was the one thing Joseph wasn't sure they could put back together.
"You said if I was quiet, if I stood very still, they wouldn't come for me," Papa said.
It took Joseph a moment to realize his father was talking to him. Joseph's breath caught. His father was talking about the medical inspection. When Joseph had scared his father to get him to straighten up. Papa looked up at him, his eyes red from crying.
"You said they wouldn't come for me. You said they wouldn't send me back. You promised, and they came for me anyway."
Joseph felt like his father had slapped him, even though Papa hadn't touched him. Joseph reeled. He backed into his mother's little makeup table, and one of the bottles Shindik hadn't smashed rolled off and shattered on the floor beside him. Joseph didn't even jump. He had lied to his father, betrayed him, made him think he was back at that awful place, terrified him all over again. But that wasn't the worst thing he had done. Joseph had made his father a promise he couldn't keep.
Isabel. Somewhere on the streets of Florida, 1994. 2 days from home. Rain lashed Isabel as she shoveled water out of the boat. Scoop, pitch. Scoop, pitch. The bottom of the boat filled as fast as they could bail it out. Isabel, her mother, her father, her grandfather, Luis, Iván, Señora Castillo, they all worked feverishly, none of them talking. Not that they could hear each other over the storm. The only ones not bailing were Señor Castillo, who looked like a ghost, and Amara, who clung to the rudder with white-knuckled hands and tried to keep the boat turned into the churning waves so it wouldn't capsize. The engine hadn't worked since their escape from the tanker. The storm clouds turned the day into night, and the driving rain soaked Isabel to the bone. She shivered in the cold wind, her feet numb in the water sloshing at the bottom of the boat. Sea spray stung her eyes, and in between scoops of water, she dragged her arm across her face, trying to wipe away the saltwater tears. As she watched the surging waves, Isabel remembered the last time she had seen her abuelita, her grandma. She remembered Lita's hand reaching out for help as the tide swept her away. Isabel had been 9 years old. Her parents had sent her to stay with Lito and Lita in their little shack on the coast. They hadn't said why, but Isabel was old enough to know her parents had been fighting again, and they wanted to be alone while they worked things out. All that spring, Isabel had waded without joy in the ocean, waiting for the storm to come that would tear her family apart. And then the real storm had come. It wasn't a hurricane. It was bigger than a hurricane. A gigantic cyclone that stretched from Canada, down through the United States and across Cuba, and into Central America. Later, they would call it the storm of the century, but to Isabel, it was the storm. The shrieking wind ripped roofs off houses and pulled palm trees straight out of the ground. The rain fell sideways. Hail shattered windows like a never-ending shotgun blast. And the ocean. The ocean rose up like a giant hand and reached inland, over Lito and Lita's little house by the sea, smothering the house in its giant paw and dragging the shattered pieces back into its lair. Lito and Lita hadn't known the storm was coming, or they wouldn't have been there. They would have been inland, found higher ground. Castro had promised he would protect them, but he didn't. Not then. Not Isabel's grandmother. Lito had been able to hold on to Isabel, but Lita had been swept away. She had slipped under the waves, her arms still reaching for Lito, for Isabel. And that was the last they had ever seen of her. Lito's arm found Isabel again now, and wrapped her in a hug.
"I know what you're thinking,"
he said close to her ear where she could hear him.
"I'm thinking about it too."
"I miss her," Isabel told her grandfather.
"I miss her too,"
Lito said.
"Every day."
Real tears came into Isabel's eyes now, and Lito hugged her tighter.
"That was her song's end,"
Lito whispered.
"But ours plays on. Come, keep bailing, or soon it'll be up to our eyeballs."
Isabel nodded and went back to scooping water. What if her life was a song? No, not a song. A life was a symphony, with different movements and complicated musical forms. A song was something shorter, a smaller piece of a life. This journey was a song, Isabel realized, a son cubano, and each part of it was a verse. The first verse had been the riot, a blast of trumpets, the rat-a-tat-tat of a snare drum. Then the pre-chorus of trading her trumpet for gasoline, the piano that gave the son its rhythm, and then the chorus itself, leaving home. They were still leaving home, still hadn't gotten to where they were going. They would return to the chorus again and again before they were done. But what was the refrain? And how many more verses would there be before they got to the climax of the song, that brash moment at the end of a son cubano that echoed the refrain, and then the coda, those brief few notes that tied it all together? She couldn't think about that now. All she could do now was scoop water. Scoop water and pray they didn't drown in the mad conga solo that drummed against the side of their tiny metal boat.
Mahmoud, Somewhere on the Mediterranean Sea, 2015, 11 days from home. The cold water was like a slap in Mahmoud's face. Before he could think, he gasped, sucking in a mouthful of the dark Mediterranean Sea. He tumbled backward, head down in the murky water, his arms and feet thrashing, trying to right himself. Something else, someone else, fell on top of him, pushing him deeper down into the water. He choked, coughed, swallowed more water. Bodies tumbled into the water above him, beside him, below him. His knee struck something hard and sharp, a rock, and he felt a cold flash of pain that quickly disappeared into blind, senseless terror. He was drowning. The rubber dinghy had burst against the rocks, and he was drowning. Mahmoud kicked, paddled, flailed. His face came out of the water, and he gulped down air, and then a wave washed over him again, and he went down. He kicked his way back to the surface and fought to keep his head above water. "Mom! Dad!" Mahmoud cried. His yells were mixed with the screams and cries of the other passengers who made it back to the surface. All around Mahmoud, survivors thrashed and gasped, swamped by the choppy waves. There was nothing left of the dinghy,
The engine had dragged the rest of it down. Mahmoud saw something bobbing along the water, glowing. A cell phone. It was still sealed tight in its plastic bag, the air in the bag keeping it afloat. Mahmoud swam for it, ducking a wave and pawing the bag into his arms. The glowing phone screen said 2:32 a.m.
Help! Help!
Mahmoud's mother sobbed, her voice recognizable in the chaos. Mahmoud spun, oriented himself, and frog-kicked his way through the waves toward the shape he thought was his mother. He picked her pink headscarf out of the swirling pandemonium and saw that she was fighting to lift something up out of the water. Hannah. Mahmoud swam to his mother. Hannah was crying. She was alive! But it was all Mahmoud's mother could do to keep the baby and her own face above the relentless waves. One or the other of them was going to drown. Mahmoud put his arms around his mother and tried to kick her and Hannah both to the surface, but half the time he felt like he was dragging them down with him.
Fatima! Mahmoud!
He heard his father cry. Mahmoud turned to see his father with Walid in his arms.
The life preservers are useless! He roared,
his head appearing and disappearing behind the waves.
They're fakes!
Fake! Mahmoud was furious, but his anger quickly faded. Every ounce of his energy was focused on kicking, swimming. If he stopped, he and his mother and sister would drown. There were other people around them, yelling, searching, fighting to stay afloat. But as far as Mahmoud was concerned, his world was 4 meters round. Where did they go from here? How did they get out of the sea and onto dry land? They were lost in the stormy Mediterranean Sea in the middle of the night. Their dinghy was sunk, and though it had run into rocks, there wasn't any land in sight. They were going to die here. All of them. Mahmoud breathed in seawater through his nose and hacked it up. He fought to breathe, the waves lapping over him, and rain and spray still lashing his face. But his baby sister's cries refocused him. He could not lose her. He couldn't lose any of them. They came together in the water, Mahmoud and his mother and father, all of them helping Hannah and Walid and each other stay afloat. Other families and groups did the same, but eventually the little groups drifted apart from each other, none of them knowing which way they were supposed to go. All they could do was stay on top of the next wave, the next wave, the next wave.
Kick off your shoes, Mahmoud's father told them. Anything to lighten you.
Time passed. The rain stopped. The waxing moon even peeked out from behind a cloud. But just as quickly it was dark again, and the cold wind and the salty spray and the swelling sea still tormented them. Mahmoud's legs were numb with cold and exhaustion. They felt like two lead weights he struggled to lift and churn to stay afloat. His mother had been quietly sobbing for what seemed like forever. Her arms no longer held Hannah above the water, but just on top of it, like she was pushing along a tiny barge. Mahmoud's father did the same with Walid, trying to save his strength. Hannah had gone as quiet as Walid, and Mahmoud wondered if they were still alive. He couldn't ask, wouldn't. If he didn't ask, he couldn't know for sure, and as long as he didn't know for sure, there was a chance they were still alive. Mahmoud slipped beneath the waves once more, longer this time. It was getting so hard to come up again, to keep himself afloat. He rose again, pushing air out of his nose, but he was tired. So very, very tired. He wished for a respite from swimming, just a moment to sit without working his arms and legs, to close his eyes and go to sleep. Water was sloshing in and out of Mahmoud's ears, but he thought he heard a drone just above the howl of the wind. In Syria, that sound would have sent him ducking for cover, but now it made his eyes widen, his legs kick just a little harder, a little higher. There, coming at them out of the darkness, another dinghy full of people! Mahmoud and his mother and father waved their arms and cried out for help. At last the people on board saw them, but as the dinghy came closer, it didn't slow down. They weren't going to stop. The front of the dinghy chopped past Mahmoud, and he lunged for one of the handholds on the side. He caught it and grabbed his mother before the dinghy pulled him away. He swung Mom to the side of the dinghy, and she grabbed